This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Joshua Cutchin is here, and he's author of The Ecology of Souls, which is a two-volume set with The Companion, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal. Tim Swartz is our guest co-host. Joshua, I think I want to run back to this because a lot of people who have been exposed just to UFOs, general ghost stuff, listen to you and say, oh, what are you talking about? And this is, of course, one of the problems we have. Like, for now, if you believe the U.S. government investigating UFOs, all the sightings started in 2004. There is a provision in the legislation to look at physical effects, but none of them even begin to remotely hint at any of this stuff.
A couple of things come to mind, and this is something that, you know, I was giving a talk on A Trojan Feast, my first book, and about, you know, the food and drink and these encounters, and some lady in the audience said, well, you know, I've had experiences all my lifetime, and I've never had this happen to me. And I said, well, I said, I've been driving all my lifetime, and I've never had a blowout. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Don't say that. On the way home tonight, you may find two tires are going. Two tires are going to go, plus one of the valves in your engine, so be careful what you say.
I'm just superstitious enough. Maybe I should knock on wood. But yeah, I have a frustration with the current, I call it sort of a technological fetish that the UFO community has, and it's fine. And, yes, a lot of it does look like technology. I get it. And I'm not saying that there isn't something like that at play. But again, I sort of want to shed light on these things that we don't talk about, you know, to the actual disclosure issue specifically. Something I talk about later in the book, you know, because people will say, oh, well, but we have metamaterials and, you know, things show up on radar. Well, number one, Jung talks about things showing up on radar and the idea that maybe psychic phenomena can do that. He does talk about that in addition to, you know, non-physical things having physical effects. But to the metamaterials and disclosure specifically, you know, I say in the book at one point, I say, you know, well, if Thor's hammer existed and we got a sample of it, what would that analysis yield? You know, it would probably say unknown or we can't manufacture it on Earth. Now, of course, I understand why some people might find that a little bit silly, but I think it does underscore the point of government secrecy. Like, which upends your view of the world and your day-to-day life more? The idea that reality resembles Close Encounters of the Third Kind, or the idea that reality resembles the Iliad or the Odyssey? You know, I know which one I find stranger personally. There's been a government motivation since, you know, at least the Roman Empire, probably earlier.
By the way, when you bring up Close Encounters of the Third Kind, one of the things people don't talk so much about is the core question here, where several people are summoned to meet E.T. and go off with them to another planet, possibly, as a kind of a cultural exchange. Now, that message was not conveyed to them physically that we know about.
Right.
They just know that they have to go there.
You know what, Gene? You make another fantastic point. It's funny how whenever people talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind, they sort of gloss over the telepathy angle, right? You know, I've gotten in trouble on this show in the past for saying that telepathy is antithetical to materialism and physicalism. And, you know, maybe that is out of line. But at the very least, it suggests that reality is a lot stranger than we give it credit for. And I think because this whole phenomena is stranger than we give it credit for, something like telepathy is real and does exist, then it suggests that we should at least be looking at some of these alternative explanations that do cross over into that dreaded woo-woo territory. So I think that's an excellent point, really.
You bring up metamaterials, and the odd thing, and this harkens back also, I think, to the fairy lore, is that a lot of times when this material, you know, bits and pieces that were seen and actual UFO sightings and encounters that have been collected afterwards, you know, the UFO debris, and analyzed, a lot of times it's found to be very common, very mundane metals. Tin, aluminum, things mm-hmm. like that, rather than something, you know, exotic that was, you know, constructed in orbit around Alpha Centauri or something.
That puts me in the mind of a couple of different things. And I guess the first one that I would talk about would be, we've always had artifacts from the other. We've had fairy flags. We've had little tiny fairy boots made out of mouse skin. We've had saints relics, sometimes contradictory saints relics. You know, well, the saint must have had 14 fingers because there are too many fingers that are hanging out around there. Yet these things do seem to have their own anomalous attributes and certainly exercise a certain degree of power over people and their expectations. So I tend to, in that sort of very Patrick Harper sense, frame these around being just sort of relics that almost, dare I say, spontaneously generate, you know, like a ports or something, right? In poltergeist cases. The other thing it puts me in the mind of is, you know, a great example of that, what you were speaking to specifically, is these implants that people find. And, you know, they're always cut out and they're almost uniformly, you know, a bit of ceramic or, you know, calcified iron or something like that, you know. And of course the response from the ETH community is like, oh, well, they're so advanced that they don't look like technology. And again, maybe. But once you take a look at a lot of these traditions from around the world and the very strong tradition that you'll find in a lot of different cultures of spirit darts and basically projectiles from the other world or from spirits or from ghosts or evil, you know, magical practitioners, they're almost always revealed to be mundane. Like, they're almost always revealed to be a rock or, you know, a leaf or a twig or something. You can also find that in fairy folklore as well. If you offended the fairies, they might send a blast of blustery wind to give you a blister. All these share the same root word. And that fairy blast, which manifests as a blister, when it was lanced, would almost always have, you know, junk inside of it, string or bits of bone or bits of twigs or rocks or glass. So I think, to me, I don't necessarily know what that says about the phenomena beyond the fact that it definitely seems to be part and parcel of the same thing.
That's used out, by the way, as a device to debunk this. Well, it's not an alien alloy like trinium from Stargate or something like that. It's from Earth. It's common minerals, common substances, tree branches, whatever it is. It is not alien, therefore, being not provably alien, it couldn't possibly be from another planet. But then again, if you look for this search for life on other worlds, okay? And what are they looking for? They're looking for planets with Earth-like conditions. And if they have Earth-like conditions, well, so life can spawn there. Earth-like conditions mean a breathable atmosphere, similar vaguely in composition to the atmosphere of Earth. It could mean native minerals, native fauna, flora, native animals, other creatures that have some vague semblance to what we see here. That's the universe we see, of course, in Star Trek, Stargate, and Star Wars. It's mostly to save money on putting strange things on people's faces to make them look weird, but they all depict human-type beings, and maybe that's the way it is. If E.T. lands tomorrow and you examine something of which a spaceship is made, hey, it's not going to be so different.
Well, you know, a sort of riff on that idea is one of the most common criticisms of the extraterrestrial hypothesis are things that I'm very sympathetic to, like, well, why are these things bipedal? Like, why do they look so human, right? In the spirit of intellectual honesty, you have to say, well, maybe there's something intrinsic about the universe where the bipedal configuration is just more suitable for intelligent life, and there's some sort of unwritten rule of evolution or tendency for intelligent life to gravitate towards that particular configuration. You know, I'm not sure. I think that if you look at sort of Earth analogs, there is some evidence that we should expect some commonalities. You know, I had a friend who has interest in some of these subjects who works at Jet Propulsion Labs, and we were talking about it, and he made the observation that some scientists have talked about the fact that octopus eyes so closely resemble human eyes, and yet they grew up in, or grew up, they evolved in such a vastly different environment than we have, suggests that there is some sort of governing tendency for evolution to evolve eyes that way. So some of the latest thinking suggests that we would see eyes that look at the visible spectrum or different spectra of light on alien worlds as well. I don't know.
As well, we have to do this pause that refreshes or something of that nature with Tim, Joshua, and Gene. You're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
Hey, trader, listen up. The markets have changed. Have you changed your trading strategies? Vantage Point can help you conquer volatility. Learn to trade with artificial intelligence. Text the word money to 813-813 and discover how to predict stock market trends 1 to 3 days in advance with up to 87.4% proven accuracy. No matter which way the market moves, Vantage Point's patented AI can give you a massive edge. Text money to 813-813 to get what you need to stay ahead of markets and find your best entries and exits. Text the word money to 813-813.
Trading involves financial risk and is not suitable for all investors. Past results do not guarantee future performance. By texting, you agree to the terms available at vantagepointsoftware.com/terms and consent to receive calls and texts using automated technology about offers or info by or on behalf of Vantage Point. Your consent is not a condition to purchase and can be revoked at any time. Message and data rates may apply.
Text money to 813-813.
GCN's policy is open forum, avoiding censorship. Defense costs for words spoken outside of our control supersede the ability to deliver voices to this important talk platform. The First Amendment is the foundation of our core values. Cancel culture is silencing voices regardless of perspective. Freedom to speak is in the balance. Support the legitimacy of speech itself. Consider donating to SaveGCN.com. That's SaveGCN.com.
I am a non-attorney spokesperson representing a team of lawyers who've helped people that have been injured or wronged. Have you been diagnosed with cancer? Are you one of the millions who have taken Zantac or other generic versions of this popular drug to help treat stomach issues? Then pay close attention to this message. The FDA said it detected low levels of a probable cancer-causing chemical known as NDMA in Zantac and other generic forms of this popular drug. They've banned sales and even removed it from the market. If you've been diagnosed with cancer and you've taken Zantac or a generic equivalent, call the legal helpline now. You could receive a free cash award and have your medical expenses covered. And there's no upfront cost to you. They only get paid if you win. So please call now. 800-998-7173. 800-998-7173. 800-998-7173. That's 800-998-7173.
As Dr. Wallach says, we all have nutrient deficiencies in our diets and must supplement with 90 essential nutrients in proper balances. At no cost or obligation, get a personal certified holistic health coach to help you develop a supplement program based on Dr. Wallach's recommendations. Call Linda at 833-VITAL-90. That number to call is 833-848-2590. That's 833-VITAL-90.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
So E.T. is sometimes depicted as an intelligent octopus or a heptapod from the movie Arrival, where intelligent beings with multiple limbs, but not quite an octopus.
Mm-hmm. So I'd read the short story before I saw the film, and it's actually a fantastic adaptation of it. But yeah, for my money, that's one of the best E.T. films to have come out in the past probably decade, honestly. You know, I always have this problem with extraterrestrial media where it's like, you know, they have this fantastic technology and they come down from the stars and then they step out and they're like mindless, bloodthirsty monsters. It's like, give me some smart aliens again. And Arrival definitely scratched that itch, I guess, for me.
Well, in the Stargate series, the Gauld are scavengers. They take the technology of others, and they appropriate it for themselves. So, of course, that explains why some pretty bizarre creatures can be heavily advanced. But then the other thing we never look at in terms of this is if there's a physical phenomenon, and E.T. is 5,000 years ahead of us, how could we possibly begin to comprehend their technology? I mean, consider this, just taking an iPhone or an iPad back to somebody 50 or 100 years ago, and it's exotic and it totally cannot be understood. Think of hundreds or thousands of years. You know, is this the Q continuum?
Well, you know, it's like that old Arthur C. Clarkeism that any sufficiently advanced technology would look like magic. But I do think, again, this is not going to be for everybody, but if you entertain the idea that the materialist paradigm might not be the way that the world operates and that there might be something to things like magic and magical thinking, then you have to acknowledge that truism that he employs is kind of a double-edged sword, and that any magic would resemble sufficiently advanced technology. Again, you know, I'm not magically operant myself, even though I'm familiar with a lot of that stuff, but I think it's worth a consideration.
Everything we do here, we're trying to interpret in some conventional way. But obviously, when we talk about advanced technology, I think of the scene in Contact. People don't like me mentioning movies and pop culture because what we understand about UFOs is framed within pop culture or Bigfoot or ghosts, so we have to do that. So that example, another smart sci-fi movie, is that E.T. has an appearance we couldn't accept. So therefore, E.T. appears in the image of the father of the protagonist, played by Jodie Foster. And explain to her, this is why we are doing this. Otherwise, again, you would not accept us. And that could be part of it right there. Or it could be that they have a shape or a configuration that's pure energy. That's why I said Q continuum.
Well, I mean, I think that that's a really good point. And again, that's this sort of co-creation theory in a bit of a nutshell. But there's always been this interplay between the fiction and the reality of sightings. I mean, you can cite, you know, how the UFO phenomenon always stays like one step ahead of us, one generation ahead of us, from, you know, steampunk airships around the turn of the century and then black triangles before we really have the unrolling of the stealth bomber. And then now, you know, Art Deco flying saucers back in the 50s, and it always seems just a little bit more advanced than what we have. But also, Martin Kottmeyer, who I think is one of the great unsung heroes of this field in terms of his ability to retain and collate research, made the point that a lot of the instances of electronics malfunctions from UFOs are actually prefigured in the pulps, right? I mean, that's some of the first appearances that you find are actually there. Now, of course, you can sort of quibble about whether or not we should understand all aerial phenomena as UFOs and whether or not those might have had some interactions with electronics. I don't know. But as far as, like, space people are interfering with electronics, that first appears in fiction. I believe there was, like, one thing with a motorcycle headlight around the 1910s, but, like, the sort of engine malfunction, electronics malfunction became really prominent after, I believe it was Leveland? Am I remembering that flap right? Texas. But yes. Again, oh, thank you. I always want to say Loveland, and Loveland is the frogs, right? but you can also take a look at a lot of traditions, especially from like old world traditions in Europe and whatnot. And there was always a connection between candles and ghosts, and candles being blown out being, you know, a death omen or something like that. So I kind of wonder if it's also not a reinvention of that as well. And oddly enough, you know, you do find a couple of examples of engine interference in ghost stories that I was able to dig up as well. Again, not saying that these are all the same thing. I suspect they are, and that's definitely the stance that I take in the book. But I think that one has to admit that if the Venn diagram isn't a perfect circle, like I suspect, it's still a Venn diagram. And these things tend to use similar mechanisms or manifest in similar ways, even if they're not fundamentally related.
Well, the engine, car engines failing, charged batteries going dead. I mean, you see that in both ghost and UFO sightings. I mean, I definitely the ghost sightings, because I've had that experience myself.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I wanted to find missing time stories in ghost stories, and I wasn't really able to find many, because the ones that you find tend to be like more of the time slip variety. And I think that says a lot about what ghost sightings are, right? Like it's something coming through to us rather than us going to it, which is what I would suggest the missing time thing really represents. You know, it's you going aboard the UFO, it's you going to Fairyland, it's you going into the trip, it's you going into the near-death experience, the near-death realm, right? But I did speak with a ghost investigator out of North Carolina who didn't have missing time. He was at an old service station that was supposedly haunted. He didn't have missing time, but every one of his new batteries, and I spoke to this gentleman firsthand. He was on a panel that I was doing, so I have no reason to disbelieve him. Every single one of his new batteries, which he had just replaced, and all of his equipment was corroded.
Ooh.
I don't know how that happens overnight. You know, I mean, even if you've got like environmental factors, that's not going to happen overnight. That does imply that there's some sort of time weirdness there. And I didn't get a chance to talk about time because, you know, the book itself, volumes 1 and 2 of The Ecology of Souls, is about the third length of the Bible. And I don't think it's a virtue that it's that long, but like, I'm not going to talk about richer causality and time loops and all this stuff, because it's just going to add another, you know, 50,000 words at least. So, and still not get any answers, right?
That'll be your next book.
Oh, not for a while. Let's put it that way. Yeah, not for a while.
Well, you were talking about earlier about culture and you know, perceptions based off of culture. It reminds me of the story that you have in here that took place at the in 1981 at the Mozambique-Zimbabwe border, and I find that story just fascinating.
I adore this story because it has so many. Ramifications, if we accept this interpretation, right? Clifford Mushina, who was working in his village at the time, saw a bright light descend, and he rang the village bell because he thought it was a fire at first. And before he collapsed, he saw these three figures in these silvery overalls, appear. And, as it turns out, several other people in the village also saw this exact same thing, including the entities. And it was all investigated and corroborated by Cynthia Hind, who did a lot of great work in Africa, trying to bring some of those stories out to the West and in Western ufology. And Mushina said that he thought that these were his ancestors, and that everyone who was there thought they were ghosts. And Cynthia Hind said, well, you know, with all due respect, wouldn't your ancestors be wearing something different than these silvery space age overalls? And he shrugs and goes, well, times change.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
And we'll find out why in our next segment with Joshua. Tim and Gene, you're in.
The Podcast.
For listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions, SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
G'day, I'm Jamel that works with Dr. Joel Wallach and the GCN team with Youngevity at teamg'day.com. By becoming an associate, you provide income for you and your family on your own hours while working from home. So contact me, Jamel, by filling in the contact box at teamgaday.com, and I will get back to you personally and provide all the support you need to get started and build your longevity business. Teamgaday.com. Teamgaday.com.
USA Radio News.
I'm Tony Maruso reporting. An armored truck house took place on California's Interstate 5 that has left law enforcement officials stymied. Two armored guards left their Brinks big rig, giving a gang of thieves a 27-minute window to make a huge snatch. Its total value is still a mystery, but estimates range from $10 to $100 million. Prices for used cars have skyrocketed. With more, here's USA Radio Network's Tim Bird.
Americans are paying near-record prices for used cars. A report from the car shopping app Copilot reveals the going rate is about $10,000 above pre-pandemic levels. It puts the average price for a used vehicle at over $33,000 in June. That's a 0.5% increase from May and just below the survey's peak in March. Copilot's CEO saying the demand for used cars remains strong.
This is USA Radio News. A man in his 90s was sentenced to life in prison this week in Texas on an arson conviction. Prosecutors say 91-year-old Kermit Gable is a career criminal with a rap sheet going back decades. But at his sentencing hearing, defense attorney Kurt Noel said his client was offered a 2-year plea deal before the case went to trial.
State wants a life sentence. They have never in my 37 years when life was available asked for anything less.
A Michigan school shooter remains in big boy jail. Here's Tim Bird with more.
Ethan Crumbly, the accused Michigan school shooter, will remain behind bars in adult jail. Crumbly was in court Friday for his monthly hearing on if he can be moved to a children's juvenile center. The judge in Pontiac, Michigan, denied that request. Crumbly is accused of killing 4 students and injuring 7 others at Oxford High School in November of last year when he was 15 years old. His trial is set to begin in January.
This is USA Radio News.
Hi, this is Sophie Winnick, longtime distributor and user of longevity products. In the last few years, my family went through a crisis. Everything else in my life, including my business, had to be put on the back burner. Thankfully, life is getting back to normal now. But the one thing I never had to worry about was my business and my monthly commission. I've been a distributor for longevity for over 17 years, since before it was longevity. And I've got to say, the most amazing thing about this company is the people. While my family was in crisis, other distributors stepped in and helped my customers, simply because that's what longevity people do, even for people they don't know. For me, it has never been about getting rich. It was about a product I could stand behind, a company I could count on, and a monthly commission check that has never, not once, been late in 17 years. Longevity is truly a business for everyone, even people who have too much to do. I'm Sophie Winnick. I'm just like you. I have a real life, real ups and downs, but I know I will always have longevity.
This is Tracy Torme, screenwriter, producer. You're listening to Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
So times change. And therefore, if you die, you'll be wearing what you died in?
Well, the implication and what this anecdote is getting at is something that you see in a lot of actually, you know, indigenous cosmologies. And it's this idea that there is continued evolution in the afterlife after we die. And this is really far out stuff, and it runs contrary to all our perceptions of the way the afterlife works. But you find this, for example, in certain Korean cultures, you know, what they will give to the ancestors might change, because in this one example that I found from a shaman from Jeju Island, she actually rejected an offering of a white cloth garment because the ancestors wear more sophisticated clothing now. But you find the same idea, the idea that the afterlife has its own parallel continuing evolution in things like the idea that the Chinese afterlife was the empire, just a mirror version of that. Certainly this is the case with the Egyptian afterlife, the Tuat, where you had to get up and go to sleep and farm your crops and worship and do all these things and eat. You know, all these mundane things still continue. This is an idea that has sort of actually wound its way through a lot of latter half of the 20th century ufology. There are some individuals who've actually suggested that maybe these things are being built on the other side. I know that's far out, but it's an idea that many people have played with. And, you know, to the extent that even in, I think the most modern example of this idea of afterlife technology comes from Whitley's new book, A New World, where he has sort of reevaluated exactly what his implant is. And he claims that he was told that it was afterlife technology that was developed by electronic voice phenomenon pioneer Constantine Radové from the afterlife. Like, he died and he designed this and he somehow shared it with officials who put it in his head as a means of communicating with the dead. So it's a strange idea. It's completely unpalatable to a lot of our ideas of, again, not only the UFO phenomena, but just what happens to us after we die. But you see it a lot of places and it kind of makes me wonder.
That's funny because there, and it wasn't so predominant here in the United States. It was more in Europe, and it was called, instead of EVPs, it was called, what, ITC. And it involved using television's video cameras to try to contact the other side. And one of the aspects of that was that allegedly the people here, you know, the living people, were working with scientists on the other side to develop new technologies to communicate across the border, so to speak.
Yeah, like instrumental transcommunication or something like that, I think.
Yes, yes, thank you.
I love the idea, not necessarily because I think it's true, but because I think it's absolutely fascinating. And you can see, you know, you can see some of these other similarities, which I find really compelling. For example, there's an ITC, a researcher in Brazil, who was using her research just to get what she perceived as the voices of the dead. Then that's when the extraterrestrial voices started bleeding through. And you sort of have to wonder, I mean, it doesn't say it's the same phenomenon, but if both these so-called extraterrestrials can communicate through these means and the dead can as well, then it implies that there's something going on there. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't aware of that specific example. If I was, I probably would have put it in the book. But I think, you know, if you can look at, I believe that, you know, Edison was working on a means of communicating with the telephone with the dead as well. And it's simultaneously quaint and very confronting. But what I like about it too is that it's like the ultimate breakaway civilization, right? Like, it's not a breakaway civilization on some foreign island or underground or anything like that. Like, it's an interdimensional breakaway civilization and it's just us. Like, I find that to be a fascinating idea.
What about the idea of a breakaway civilization right here on Earth, in caves, under the ocean, somewhere else, that they are existing separately from us for whatever reason, and either we have some kind of vague contact with them at secret government levels, or what?
Yeah, I'm not prepared to mount a counter-argument to it, because I think some aspects of it are really compelling. You know, I would say, again, that all these places where these ultra-terrestrials dwell and where these breakaway civilizations dwell are almost always places that were the other world in the afterlife. I mean, an example that I love to use, mountains, right? Mountains are so commonly attributed sites of UFO bases, right? Sometimes the UFOs, sometimes people say there's a, you know, a panel in the side of the mountain or something. There is actually an example that I found from Bob Teets, who saw a UFO go into a mountain, like just like straight into a mountain without like crashing or there being a portal opened or anything like that. It just went straight into the ground. But if you look at sort of that mountain association, you can trace it back to, predictably enough, fairies and the dead. You know, mountains and hills were obviously associated with the fae folk. That's part of what the Mountains and Monuments chapter is in Volume 1. But also that association might have itself spawned from the idea that a lot of times the dead were said to dwell on or in mountains. It was very common, especially in, you know, Western medieval literature, to think of the dead as sort of living a second life within the mountain. Similarly, you know, in Japan, lots of times grave sites would be on the tops of mountains, and certain parts of Kenya, ancestral spirits would dwell, you know, around or in mountains. And, you know, for a couple of different reasons, you know, burial mounds look a lot like mountains. I'm not sure if it's chicken or the egg, if those were designed to look like mountains or, you know, or vice versa on some sort of archetypal level. But also, you know, the idea that when you're on top of a mountain, you theoretically are closer to the heavens. You know, it's the Axis Mundi, like connecting heaven to earth, and you are literally closer to the divine when you're atop a mountain. But again, I find it so interesting that things like breakaway civilizations and UFOs still retain that mountain connection that has been with us since, I mean, arguably time immemorial.
Now, as I've grown older, I've become increasingly afraid of going up mountains. I won't drive up mountainous roads. I will not do it. So, for example, if I want to go to Sedona, Arizona from the Phoenix area, there's a mountainous road on the way, and I will not go there anymore. I mean, if someone has a Stargate or can transport me, you know, Scotty beam me up or something or send me over there, I would do it in a heartbeat, but now I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, I remember probably 8 years ago, I was at a wedding on top of a mountain, and it was like literally a 15 or 20 minute drive up this mountain up these winding roads. And I'm like, well, nobody's going home tipsy tonight because you're going to go straight off the side of the mountain. Yeah. It can be quite confronting, especially like, you know, out west, they don't have nearly as many guardrails as you do out east here.
Right. I was able to do it far easier driving up to Vermont when I lived in Vermont many thousands of years ago. No problem going up this hill to the radio station I worked at. There were two radio stations I worked at. You go up a hill, not like a high hill, but, you know, maybe couple hundred feet or something like that. No problem. I could do it. I could manage it. No big deal. But lately, I don't know. Maybe ET is telling me something.
Yeah, or it's, you know, it's that conflation with the dead, and you're just approaching the divine, and you realize it, maybe.
As I get closer and closer, being, you know, 12,000 years old, you feel that you are closer to what's going on. But then there's the other theory here about life after death, which is that maybe you've died 100 times already, but each time you go into another reality and you just move on. I just wish you'd get younger.
Yeah, and, you know, each reality, I guess, still has Monday mornings, right? I mean, that's rough.
Yeah, that part of the interdimensional travel never changes, does it?
No. Yeah, it's like, you know, I mentioned, you know, it's so funny because you see a lot of these ancient death traditions, and, you know, time and again, there's oftentimes a fee to pay the ferryman across the river. Like, it's a death and taxes, right? The two universal constants.
Which is interesting because supposedly you're not supposed to be able to take it with you. Thus, the tradition of putting the coin under a dead person's tongue so they have something to pay.
Right, which is why you've got to have very good descendants who are very conscientious and actually will take the effort to give you something. Yeah.
You know what? We're going to give people something right now. Check it out with Joshua, Gene, and Tim. You're in
The Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on the special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
First, we decide where we want to go. Then we need to know the best way to get there. Hi, my name's Adam Baratta. I'm the owner of Advantage Gold. We're the highest rated precious metals firm in the country. We teach people how to own physical gold and silver. Now, we've won the Best of TrustLink Award 4 years in a row because we educate our clients on how to buy gold and silver the right way. We don't pay celebrity spokespeople millions of dollars. We'd rather pass that value on to you. Call 800-900-8000 and speak with one of our experts. We'll send you a free gold kit along with my latest number one national best-selling book, The Great Devaluation. Call 800-900-8000. That's 800-900-8000. Get the best information, the best process, the best service, the best value. Call Advantage Gold at 800-900-8000. Call 800-900-8000.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
$92,000.
Ouch. The IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or you now need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Health Insurance Helpline can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and people just like you that need affordable health insurance to get it. We have short and long-term health insurance plans, and some even cover dental, vision, and prescription drugs. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or now need affordable health insurance, call right now and learn for free how to get it. Listen, affordable health insurance plans for everyone just like you are a free phone call away. So give us a shout right now.
800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. That's 800-670-0946.
This is Jacques Vallée, and you're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
You can't take it with you, or can you? In the movie Ghost, the guy is killed, and guess what? He's still wearing the same clothing. That's another tradition in ghost stories. You wear whatever you died in, which is fine if you die and there's no injury to the clothing, it's not ripped to shreds. If it's ripped to shreds, it gets to be a little bit ridiculous.
You know, that's an interesting point, though, that you bring up, Gene, because, you know, you see time and again these grave goods that are interred. Some people speculate that the reason that fairies are associated with gold, and, you know, you go into the fairy hill to steal the gold or leprechaun's gold or something, is because of that conflation between grave goods that people would be buried with, oftentimes massive amounts of wealth. You know, you see this time and again, and, you know, another one of those persistent grave goods are the psychopomp symbols, you know, horses. Very commonly interred, especially with royalty, and that's pretty much universal. I mean, you see some Mongolian burial mounds where they're like 15 horses or something like that. You know, ship burials. You know, we have this idea of, like, you know, Viking burials being, you know, you're put in a boat and you're sent off to sea and they fire a flaming arrow, and apparently the flaming arrows weren't common, if they happened at all. Even like pushing them out to sea wasn't as common as we're led to believe, but very much so, people were buried with ships, in ships. Even some Viking ship burials are sort of like ship effigies, so it's got this sort of elliptical ring of stones that are around the burial to symbolize the shape of a ship, which, not coincidentally, kind of looks like a flying saucer from the side or a cigar-shaped UFO.
You know, of course, that they continue that tradition in Star Trek, where in the movie Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, where Spock supposedly dies, they send his body in its coffin into space. Of course, it lands on the Genesis planet. And we therefore have the third movie that Leonard Nimoy directed. Maybe that was part of the deal. Give me another check.
You know, I've been playing with the idea for a while that Spock is like a fairy archetype, and I can't really make a good case, but the fact that he was sort of the instigating catalyst for the Genesis planet and all the vegetation that sprouted is kind of puts one in the mind of theosophic fairies as nature elementals, so maybe that's a thread I can pull on. It's another one of those, dare I say, universals where, you know, some of our first coffins were literal boats. I mean, there have been some recent excavations in China that are thousands of years old of these coffin boats or boat coffins. And again, it's that ship theme, that distant journey theme that keeps rearing its head time and time again. And honestly, like, that's something that one of the most striking things that I found regarding lake monsters was this ship coffin death link, because a lot of lake monsters are literal logs, you know, they're misidentifications, that's what the skeptics will say, and certainly that's the case in some instances. But there's also a very strong tradition that the lake monsters can change into and out of logs, like the lake monster literally can just appear as a log. The log, you know, calls to mind all sorts of things, from Jung's idea of the Totenbaum, the tree as part of, you know, sort of a Mother Earth, devouring mother, return to the womb kind of idea. But trees are basically coffins, and I know that sounds silly, but you've got that idea of that Jung put forth, and you've also got this idea that logs were the first boats, right? I mean, you know, it's probably our earliest ancestors paddled across rivers on logs before they, you know, invented the dugout canoe, turning the log into a ship, and oftentimes people would be buried in those. So you see this sort of chain of connections between the coffin to the canoe to the log to the lake monster, and I think that's in a lot of ways quite poetic.
The canoe being a transport device.
Yeah, otherworldly transport. You know, you find this in a lot of Native American myths, where sometimes that's what I'm thinking of specifically, and I'm sorry I can't remember the tribe right offhand, but there's a boy who asks a tree where his deceased, I believe, sister went, and the tree just sort of tumbles into the tree tumbles into the water, and he hops on the tree, and the tree transports him to the afterlife so he can visit his dead relative.
And that's the multiverse all over again. We are so obsessed with the multiverse, especially in pop culture now, where every comic book hero has a corresponding version of himself or herself or whatever in another universe.
Yeah, and it's been around a while, and I find it, I mean, very much in the same way that you had Volcano and Dante's Peak in the same year, or Armageddon and, what was the other one that year? I'm trying to remember. The other asteroid movie.
It's Deep called Impact. The other asteroid
Deep
movie.
Deep Impact, yeah.
Deep Impact. But you see, there's a thing here, too, which is so strange about that, which is you think, well, maybe the producers of one movie hear that another movie is underway, they will try to cash in. But if you look at how movies are made, it can take years to put together a movie. You first have to have a concept, agree to a script, agree to a director, a producer, the actors, actresses who will be in the movie. All this preparation takes years. And so if 1 year you're thinking about a movie, no guarantee it'll ever be made, and suddenly the news comes out, oh, Armageddon is under construction.
Yeah.
Will there be a deep impact? Well, how could there be that quickly? Maybe it's just that you have multiple production companies coming on with a similar idea.
Yeah, and, you know, we're definitely seeing that with multiversal things right now, not just in the superhero genre, but other films as well. And of course, some of those are copycats, but I can't help but think that there's something a little bit stranger to it, as you're alluding to. And it's almost this very Fortean idea. In the true, like, Charles Fort sense, if memory serves, and I might be wrong about this, he suggested that there was just a time and a place for us to harness steam locomotion because the teapot had whistled the secrets of harnessing the power of steam for centuries, and it was just like, at some point, it was, oh, it's locomotion time. You know, it's the Industrial Revolution, it's steam engine time. Like, everything just sort of pivoted at once. And you could probably make the same comparison to the Agricultural Revolution in antiquity as well, I would imagine. But it's kind of like the idea that some things are just pre-scripted and there's something in the air or something in the water that makes us all come to these same conclusions or do these things at their pre-scripted time.
Well, in the last Spider-Man movie, you had three different versions of Spider-Man played by the three different actors who had that role in the past 20 years, which was wacky. And then on the Crisis of Infinite Earths on the CW TV network in the U.S., they had three different versions of Superman. Two were heroes, one was a villain, and one of the heroes was the guy who played Superman in 2006 in a movie called Superman Returns, Brandon Routh. And you think, you know, obviously, you know, we're doing this to get an audience. They had two versions of The Flash, the movie version and the TV version. Same reason.
Yeah, if memory serves, I think the new Flash movie is going to be playing with multiverses as well. So I guess if you don't like multiverses, you're out of luck, and we're just going to have to weather this storm for a while.
There'll be at least two or three different versions of Batman. Ben Affleck, Michael Keaton. Why do you make Michael Keaton a new version of Batman? He must be 70 years old.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to cash in on that existing intellectual property, right?
Oh, well. Oh, well. Anyway, I don't want to get so much into the multiverse in terms of comic books or movies or things like that, but it's also part of the culture that we're being exposed to a concept that there are multiple versions of ourselves, there are alternate realities, and this has been drifting in the UFO field for many years. Most people do not hear about it. I was talking about it in the mid-60s. Jacques Vallée is talking about it. John Keel is talking about it. It's something that has percolated.
Yeah, and you know, it puts me in the mindset. I mean, I think, again, as I was alluding to with electronic interference, like, there does seem to be this interplay between fiction and reality. And, you know, you might see something Tim talked about earlier with co-creation. Another idea that people like to trot out is the idea of the tulpa, right? The thought form that supposedly Alexander David Neal learned about during her trip to Tibet, where she meditated on the idea of a portly Friar Tuck style monk that literally manifested and sort of got out of her control. You know, I'm sort of ambivalent on the idea of tulpas. I have spoken to some people who were interested in, like, you know, these strange topics, and they said that they got an audience with a highly placed Buddhist monk, and they spoke with him, and they asked them about tulpas, and they said, what? So I don't know if that's the idea that maybe it's been overblown, or the idea that's sacred knowledge that's only, you know, reserved for the highest echelons of their hierarchy. But, you know, I don't know how much I ascribe to the idea of the tulpa, but you do see lots of things that seem to emerge from fiction into reality. And I don't know if we are authoring reality, or if we're in a simulation or whatever, but there does seem to be some sort of back and forth between what we see and what we think of, you know.
We're going to think of this here with Joshua, Gene, and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
92.
$6,000.
Ouch. The IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.